My name is Matthew, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA, recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Chris will read the preamble.
Hi, everyone. I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. AA. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join us in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Jessica will read the steps.
Step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs.
Judy will now read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Judy, and I'm an alcoholic. And these are the 12 traditions. Okay. One, each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. AA must continue.
Read the short form.
Oh,
right there.
Oh,
sorry.
Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscious. Our leader are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought to never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related faculty outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought to never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible for those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Tonight is anniversary night. The format of the meeting will be, the 10-minute speaker will speak on the 10th tradition, followed by our information break. The main speaker, who will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our anniversary celebrants. Our 10-minute speaker is Esat, is how you pronounce it?
Hi, my name is Esat, and I'm an alcoholic. The 10 tradition long form. No AA group or member should ever, in such a way as to implicate AA, express any opinion on outside controversial issues, particularly those of politics, alcohol reform, or sectarian religion. The Alcoholics Anonymous groups oppose no one. Concerning such matters, they can express no views whatever. That's a long form. Before I get started, I want to thank Heidi for asking me to speak on the 10th tradition. It's both an honor and privilege to do service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's tougher to do it in front of you all. So I'm going to say that I am nervous. I did pray, and I am on information overload because many people told me to do your research, and so I did. I did print out the traditions checklist. I'm going to read that as well because that's the basis for my outline for tonight. I read a lot, I heard a lot, I talked to a lot of people, and I felt if I follow the traditions checklist and answer those questions, I wouldn't leave anything out, so to say. So in the spirit of the 10 tradition, I'm just going to say that what you hear from me tonight is my opinion based on my experiences and those that were shared with me from others. I do not speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. So Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. And so there are 7 checklist questions. And the first is, do I ever give the impression that there really is an AA opinion on antabuse, tranquilizers, doctors, psychiatrists, churches, hospitals, jails, alcohol, the federal or state government legalizing marijuana, vitamins, Al-Anon, or Alateen? And I'm sure we can go on and on and on. So what that means to me, and once again, in my opinion, and in my experience, based on the literature, expressly stating medication is the most important thing that I got from my peers in the audience tonight, which is we are not doctors. There's a professional community for that. And what that means to me is my opinion on AA matters is those opinions that directly affect my spirituality and my God as it is in relation to my sobriety and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything outside of that for me is an outside issue, including meditation, including legal issues, including marital issues. I can share my opinion on those things. I can share my experience on those things. But when I make it appear as though, or if I don't clarify that this isn't an AA opinion, or make it seem as though it is, I am breaking this tradition. And having said that, I've been exposed and I've seen in plenty of situations where people that aren't clear on what the tradition is and how that works in comparison to medication specifically can be doing more harm than good. And so if you're dispensing of medical, if you're dispensing of medical opinions and you're not qualified to do so with a medical degree, you're probably breaking the tradition. Same thing with legal advice, the same thing with a whole bunch of other advice. Through AA, I can show you how I've recovered through the steps of the program as outlined in the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous. And further from that, I can share with you my experiences on things outside of that. But when I start telling you what to do and how to do it, I'm breaking this tradition, and that could be dangerous as well. And I also want to say that I've done that before, and I hope to not continue doing that. But there are times where I've experienced, and I've talked to people as well, where there's a certain sense of inadequacy when you can't give an answer to a certain question. And just because it's an outside issue, that doesn't mean that people in the program aren't going to ask us these types of questions. And so I have to clarify within myself whether this is something that I should be dispensing information and how I send that information by clarifying it's an opinion of mine only and whether I have experience with it or not. So I hope that was clear enough. I'm going to move to the next question, and that is, can I honestly share my own personal experience concerning any of those without giving the impression I am stating the AA opinion? Once again, I can, but I fail to do that in certain occasions, and it's a common practice amongst a lot of us that I've seen and heard within the rooms and outside of the rooms as well. And for those of you who have heard me speak in other meetings, especially when I'm a chairperson speaking at the front, I clarify every time I share that although I'm at the front for those of you who are new or coming back, I'm not the AA president. I'm not in charge. My word doesn't mean more than anyone else's. It's strictly my opinion that I'm going to be sharing when my mouth opens up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I might have some good basis for that opinion. It might come exactly from the book as stated. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's an AA opinion. And I have to clarify that, and it's good that we take those steps as well. What in AA history gave rise to our 10th tradition? In the beginning, there were many controversies that were going on in the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Bill didn't know the history of the Washingtonians, and one of the group members said, you know, Bill, this is what happened with the Washingtonians, and from that point on, they've done some research. And so for those of you who haven't heard that before, the Washingtonians were a temperate society, which basically means that they were a society made up of six drunks who began the society in a bar in Baltimore. Now, I got to say that at that time there were other societies, there were other temperate societies as well. And so what these six guys have done is not only did they form their society, but they decided that there was going to be a pledge, a total abstinent pledge, and they were going to have people pledge their total abstinence forever. And they also went on a rodeo show and had the greatest orators of their time speak on behalf of the temperance movement. And they aligned themselves with other temperance movements. So there's a lot of ambiguity to the numbers, but I just want to state early on that anywhere between 100 to 600,000 people got sober through the Washingtonians, and this is within a 10-year period. But more importantly, they got over 5 million people to pledge total abstinence. Now, what that means is they went into a town in Boston, for example, and they got the entire town to pledge total abstinence. And that's men, women, and children, whether they drank or not. So anyone was included in this society. And they even convinced the wine cellar of the town to dump all his liquor and sign the total abstinence pledge. That number, 5 million people, was one quarter the U.S. population of 15 years and over. So there's a lot of power and prestige within that number right there, which attracted politicians and other people alike with different agendas. Make a long story short, including all these people with all these opinions and all these agendas, within 10 years, it broke apart. And not only did it break apart, but there was nothing after that, and that was 100 years before Alcoholics Anonymous was formed. And there weren't that many, the temperance movement died, and there weren't that many programs for alcoholics to go to. So most importantly, that's what gave rise to the 10 traditions specifically, but to the traditions in general, which all, at the end of the day, serve to protect the first tradition. The first tradition being the most important. And we don't protect the first tradition if our group purpose isn't all but one. If there isn't unity within Alcoholics Anonymous, then we all fall apart to the wayside. So the question is, have I had similar experience in my own AA life? You know, of course, when I first got sober, I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. I thought everyone needed sobriety. My alcoholic friends who didn't consider themselves alcoholic or not, but I quickly considered themselves alcoholic. And not only that, but I also thought the 12 steps could work for everyone in all areas of their life, whether they wanted it or not. And so I started screaming from the rooftops. And what I did is I created, instead of unity, I created a position where people were running away from me instead of wanting to see what I had. And so quickly, I found by doing the research on the traditions that I've broken every one of these traditions early on, and I'll continue to do so because my first idea isn't generally the best. I've got 1 minute left, and I didn't get to the end, but I guess the most important thing, some of the most important things that I've said already, what I did leave out is, in my research, the Trent tradition, in the 10th step, I take my own inventory. In the 10th tradition, I don't take yours. And so if I'm not taking your inventory, then I'm keeping my opinions to myself. And I do that still. I judge people. I gossip about people. I'm working with my sponsor. I'm making a whole bunch of amends. A lot of the amends are the same amends that I've made before because I continually judge and gossip about people a lot less than I used to, and I'm working on those issues. But those in general violate the 10th tradition as well. And so I didn't get to all my questions, but I got to the most important things. Those are my opinions and my experience on the 10th tradition. I appreciate doing service. Thank you very much.
Our main speaker tonight is Peter.
Great, thanks. Hi, everyone. My name is Peter. I'm an addict and alcoholic. My biggest fear when I walk in, I said to Heidi, gee, maybe can I get someone to just figure the microphone out? She said, we have it taken care of. We have a service commitment for that. You know, thank you for asking me to speak tonight. I'm sitting here thinking, when I'm hearing the people in the room counting days, and from, you know, one day to 5 and 38 and 69, and hearing people with anniversaries of a year and 2 years, and I think the most 26 years celebrating tonight. It's amazing. We're all doing the same thing, trying to stay away from a drink a day at a time. You're looking at a man who's very grateful for what he has. I am extremely grateful to be sober. The magic of this program remains a mystery. When I was new in this program, if you wanted to know how it works, I was the go-to guy. If you wanted to know about the steps, if you wanted to know about the traditions, if you wanted to know what you do in your life, if you wanted to know what step to work on, go to me. If you want to know how this works, don't come to me after I speak. I really don't know. There's a chapter in the big book that really clearly explains how this works and does a lot better than I could ever explain. I really can't believe. The truth is, I came, and there are some people in this room tonight, Amy and Aviva and a couple of people I know that have been around a long time, that I came in the rooms about 23 years ago. And I celebrated 18 years this last January. I have done this, thank you, but I thank you for it. I have done this several times under the influence, and I've done this now for many years clean and sober. And I will tell you, it's a lot more rewarding clean and sober than it was under the influence. My story is a story of hopelessness. I couldn't get this. I mean, I couldn't get it. I couldn't do what you're doing. I couldn't put 24 hours together. I mean, let alone trying to count to 90 days of celebrating a year or having a cake. I couldn't make it through one day. I need to be really clear. You know, and when I'm speaking, so much of what I'm saying is really as a reminder to me. You know, the book tells us not to stare back, you know, but to take a glance. I never want to forget where I've come from. I really buy the whole thing. This is not cafeteria style. I buy everything. You know, I'm not trying to rewrite the big book or rewrite the steps or have my opinion. This works really well. How does it work? It works really, really well. Somehow, I have managed to get sober and stay sober. And I still can't believe that. I still don't know how this works. I can't believe a guy like me that was so desperate that had gone so far down the scale can live two lives in one lifetime. I mean, if my friends could see me now, if you haven't done this, you need to do it. For those of you that are new, you need to speak, especially at this group. There are more than 400 people here. That's amazing. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. I just can't believe that we are all here tonight looking great. Heidi had said to me, we'll try and get here early at 6:30. I figured I'd come in at 6:30. No one would be here. When I walked across the street, there were probably 100 people outside, you know, smoking cigarettes and just, you know, talking and doing what we do. When I came in the rooms, I don't know if you can come in for the wrong reason, by the way. I came in the rooms because it's not that I wanted to get sober. I wanted to stop getting drunk. And I started drinking when I was about 17. There are some people that stand here and are really good at dates or years. I'm not really. You can't hear that from me. I'm lucky I remember what I did yesterday. But I know this. I started drinking when I was about 17. And I grew up in a home. I used to get a lot of mileage out of my mother suffering from mental illness and my father paying attention to her. And you know what I mean. Really analyzing what I did, and it was someone else's fault. And that got me no place. That got me one more drink. I started drinking when I was about 17, and I'm certainly not going to turn this into a qualification about drugs, but I just want to mention, just want to acknowledge it so I don't lie by omission, where it took me to an enormous amount of drugs, whether it be going to doctors to get drugs, or becoming a heroin addict, or loitering outside methadone clinics, and that's what alcohol did to me. It started with alcohol, it ended with alcohol. That's really what you hear about the drugs. I'm saying it so that you understand my full story, and the truth is I'm saying it really for me. When I came in at 17, when I started drinking at 17, it did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It made me, it gave me confidence. It was easy to talk to the girls. It was easy to get a date. It was I had a lot of confidence. It made me taller than I was. And without the drink, I couldn't even make a phone call to a friend. I really feel like I was a full-blown alcoholic from the first. Actually, I really think I was an alcoholic before I had my first drink. I don't know if you identify with that. I had all the isms. I had all that stuff. And when I just, you know, poured fuel in the fire, what it made was a really uncomfortable guy. And I'm sure I've heard that so many times, you understand. I appreciate the nods of the head. I mean, it just, sometimes it's, I think it's a program of the nods. When I look around and people are saying, it makes me feel like we're together in this. And I drank for 23 years. And I was willing to go to any lengths for one more drink. You know, it didn't end the way it started. The way it started was rather innocently. I mean, the way it started was in the first 30, 60, 90 days of drinking, I was taken to an emergency room, and I needed to have my chin stitched back together and some teeth had gotten knocked out. And my parents came to the emergency room on Long Island, and it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was an absolute mess. And my concern, my only concern that night, was when I looked up at my dad, and he stood over me, and I said, do you think when they're finished doing this, I could finish the night with my friends? And he knew in his own inimitable way, he said, look, son, he said, let them put the stitches in and we'll talk. And I didn't need anesthesia. And the story goes on. I mean, the many stories of flying through a plate glass window and, you know, and being picked up on the street and taken to the police station. And I needed medical attention. And my parents showed up one more time with the accidents I was in. I don't know why, I never tell this story, but I was 18 years old and I dated a girl through high school, and she should be here tonight. Not that she's a candidate for the program, but when I took her to the prom at 18 years old, I was with some other friends, and I drank these 7 and 7s and got so drunk that I grew up on Long Island, and we went into the Sands Hotel, the beach club in Atlantic Beach, and I was in a blackout, and I woke up at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was in the back of a trunk. I was in the back of a truck, and I had my beautiful powder blue tuxedo on. You know, I looked great. You know, and I walked in the dance, and there were the chaperones, and my date was sitting with the chaperones, and little Anthony and the Imperials was sitting up there. And of course, I still wanted to take her to a hotel that night. I mean, that didn't work. So she should be here to see that things have changed. By the time I came in the rooms, I came in to save my marriage. My daughter was, about 3 years old, and things weren't looking too good for me. And I came in the rooms, and I lied. I really couldn't put a day together. And after being in the rooms about 6 months or so, I ended up in, by the way, I lived on the Upper East Side. I lived right next to the 79th, the old 79th Street Workshop used to be on 79th and 2nd. And I lived in a high rise right next to it. And before I walked in the rooms, I used to walk my dog at about 11 o'clock on a Saturday night. And I'd see you guys, and you know what we do in front of the meeting place. And I knew what it was. And I must tell you something, I felt so sorry for you. I said, my God, can you imagine these poor people? The best they could do is muster up, standing in front of a meeting, making believe, having coffee and cigarettes, and making believe they're having a good time. Meanwhile, that's what I aspire to do now. Standing in front of a meeting is a joy. But I wouldn't go to meetings in my neighborhood because, God forbid, I'd see someone. I mean, any night you could see me carried into the building I lived in, but God forbid you'd see me walk down the steps of the workshop. I mean, I had an image. I mean, now I want to look good. And I went to Living Now, which was at St. Mark's Place, and it was a wild group. It was just chairs flying across the room, people getting high in the room, people drinking in the bathroom. I fit right in. I did that for 6 months until finally I met a guy on the Upper East Side at some meeting I had the courage to go to, and he convinced me to go to the workshop. And he also convinced me to go to a detox. And I went to a place in Far Rockaway. It was St. John's. I went there for 14 days. And for those of you, you know, you don't need to go through a rehab or a detox to get this. You really don't. There are some people that come in the rooms, count one day and 2 days, get a sponsor and come to meetings, and somehow they get it. I don't understand that. It isn't my story. But I went to this detox for 14 days. And I must tell you, it was 14 days of hell. It was terrible. It was 14 days that I said I would never do again. And now I did it many, many times. And everything you guys were telling me was coming true. Very simply, what you said was, you know, if you keep drinking, it's going to get worse. If you stop drinking, it's going to get better. I am way too complicated. It's way too simple for me. I mean, there must be something else to it. So I'm going to meetings, and a year later, I go to my second detox. Maybe 8 months later, I go to my third, then my fourth, and my fifth, and my sixth, and my seventh. And one of the guys pulled me to the side. By the way, I never stopped going to meetings in these 5 years. That's one thing, thank God, I never did. I never stopped going to meetings. And one of the guys said, listen, you know, you've been going to these places like Gracie Square 3 times and Interfaith. He said, maybe what you need is a place in Minnesota, Hazleton, where they serve you strawberries and there are movie stars there. I said, those are my people. I still had a few bucks, and I put it down. I was in Hazleton like within a few days. It was true. Strawberries in the morning, movie stars sitting right in front of me. I said, now I'll get it. I spent 30 days there, and I got it. I did my first 5 steps. For those of you in that kind of program, we do that. I did it to the best of my ability. I got on a plane, and I sat next to a guy who was a Bible manufacturer. He was selling Bibles, and this was great. I had found God. I talked to him about my experiences. I talked to him about what I had gone through, and he said to me, listen, he said, if you're looking for a job, I was so excited. I didn't have a job. I met a guy that was offering me a job. I was so excited. We landed at LaGuardia, and I had a drink, and it's the God's honest truth. It's like it was too good for me to handle. By the time I got home, I was ready to go to another detox or another rehab, and in total, I went to 9. I was institutionalized 9 times. And what had happened at the very end for me was this. We were about to lose our apartment. And my daughter was 7 years old. I went to court to see if we could slow the process down. Judge gave me another chance. I knew I couldn't live up to it, but that's the alcoholism. I figured it would buy me some time because I'm going to figure this out. And turned out we were about to lose our apartment, and I didn't know what to do. And my wife said, look, we are, our daughter and I are moving out. We found another apartment, and good luck. And I didn't know what to do, and I called my parents, and I asked if I could have a place to stay with them for a couple of weeks and get my life together. At any rate, my parents picked me up, and they put my clothes in the back seat like you'd pick up a college student, and we went out to my parents and I. The morning I woke up, it was a rude awakening. When I woke up, you know, it was the same bedroom I had gone to middle school to and high school, and there wasn't a toot in the horn outside. There were no friends there to pick me up. I was a full-blown alcoholic, and things were terrible. I'd been in the rooms for just about 5 years then, and actually it was this month, 19 years ago, that I ended up homeless. And the only reason I wasn't on a street or in a shelter or sleeping in Central Park is because my parents were kind enough to give me a room to sleep in. And I woke up and I didn't know what to do, and the pain I was in was excruciating. The physical pain I was numb to, I had done that for 5 years, and you know what I mean. You can toughen that up. You can go through withdrawal. You muster something up, and you can do that. But the emotional pain I was in was beyond what I thought I could handle. You told me that God didn't give me more than I could handle, but I was really at the limit. So I put a knife to my wrist, and I didn't cut myself, but I wanted to know how it felt. Because it was an out. This wasn't working. I had been in the rooms for 5 years. I had been at 8 institutions by then. I really didn't know what to do. And a friend called, and thank God there were some wonderful angels in the room that never gave up on me. They really wanted me to get sober more than I wanted to get sober. And said, look, I work for the state, and we fund a therapeutic community on the Lower East Side, and if you're interested, I'll help get you in there. Here I am with a knife to my wrist, stealing money out of my mother's pocketbook, an absolute maniac, and I did what any good alcoholic would do. I said, let me get back to you. And I really did. I wasn't, because he said this commitment would be 12 to 18 months. 12 to 18, don't you understand? I have things to do. 12 to 18 months. I have a knife to my wrist, stealing money, drinking. And I called him the next day, and my parents didn't want me there. And I said I would go. And my father, we walked to, I told him I was going, and it was the 9th institution I was to go to. And my father walked me to the Lawrence Railroad Station. And by the way, I had no money. I was bankrupt. Sometimes people say that, and they have like a CD or a money market account or a few dollars. I mean, I've heard people say that. I have a condominium. They say I'm bankrupt, I'm homeless, but I have a car outside. I'm saying nothing. I mean, I didn't have $5. I couldn't buy a pack of cigarettes. And my father took me to the Lawrence train station, and he said, I said, look, I need a, you know, told him what I was doing. I figured I'd get a round-trip ticket, you know, to go to the city. He bought me a one-way ticket. I knew this was not good. Then I said, I never asked him for money. Even when I was 17, 18, I got a job after school. I never asked him for a dollar. I said, I figured he's going to say yes. I said, Dad, I got to make it from the Penn Station to the Lower East Side. I said, maybe you can give me a few dollars. I was smoking cigarettes also. Well, I'll never forget. I tell this story as a reminder to me. He said to me, son, you're on your own. And boy, I will tell you something. I never forgot those words. And by the way, he wasn't Al-Anon trained, but he, by that point, he had had it with me. Somehow, he intuitively knew how to handle me. And I got on the train station. I came to the city, and I went from Penn Station to Grand Central Station. I went to a sobering up station with a suitcase in my hand, and I asked them if they'd give me a token to get to the Lower East Side. And they gave me a token, and that's where I went. I went downtown, and I lived in this. There was a 12 to 18 month program, and some are sicker than others. I lived there for more than 3 years. And I got sober. I put a day together, something I couldn't do. I put 24 hours together, and I put 2 days together, and I put 3 days together, and I had 90 days and a year, and I can't believe not only did I get sober, I stayed sober. That was amazing. And everything was new to me. Everything. I was 40 years old. And everything, I really thought my life was over. I mean, I was at that point, you know, pain, I think, is the pathway to humility. And I was in so much pain that I was willing to do anything. And that's what you taught me. But I wasn't willing. There were people in this room that used to say that to me. You got to be willing to go to any lengths. But at that point, I was in so much pain, I was. And I got sober, and life started to change. I was married, and I knew that this woman wasn't for me. And interestingly enough, my wife is sitting here with me tonight. There used to be a different meeting that met here. For those of you that have been around for a while, Midtown used to meet here. And there was a dance downstairs, and many years ago, I went to this dance, and I met the woman that I'm married to today, and we'll celebrate 13 years of being married this December. I think it's 13 years, isn't it? Okay. Life is very different today. You know, when I started off and I said I'm very grateful to be sober, I am one of those guys living two lives in one lifetime. It's as simple as that. I have been well trained by you. I don't compare myself to anyone else. I really don't. When I compare me to where I've been compared to where I am today, this is like an out-of-body experience. I mean, the idea that I have something to offer, that I have something to give back. I'm a fall-down drunk, hopeless. I couldn't put one day together. There was a time to backtrack in those 5 years. There was one time I heard Act As If, and for 7 months I lied. For 7 months in this program, I was in this program about 3 or 4 years, I actually lied. I started counting days like I always did, and I didn't understand when I got up to 70 or 80 or 85. Well, I had been around several years. People asked me to speak. This woman came to me at the workshop. She said, "Oh, Peter, I'm so happy that you're sober." She said, "Would you speak for me?" And I didn't know what to do. I didn't really know what to do. I said, "Sure." And I spoke under the influence. And I did that for a few times until I finally called my sponsor and I told him the truth. If there was any way of pushing him away, that was it. And he was very loving. He just, he said, "I don't want to talk anymore tonight about it, but call me tomorrow." I left that therapeutic community, and I divorced my first wife. I met a woman. I got married. I have a daughter who's 26 years old, and she was 7 years old when I went to treatment. She was 10 years old when I came out, and I've gotten some wonderful, wonderful gifts. When I came in, if I had gone, I didn't have very much to lose except my life, and I didn't think it was really worth anything. You know, the situation with my daughter was very different than a lot of things. It's not like a lot of things came easy to me, but things started falling in place. I mean, just like we tell people that are new, if you just whatever, you know, I have this problem, I have to just go to a meeting. Just go to a meeting and share. Go to a meeting and sit up in the front. And that's what people were telling me. And things started to work out. But with my daughter, they really weren't working out. I mean, we really couldn't bond. I tried to be a good guy. When I said I would be there at 7 o'clock, I was there at 7 o'clock. Couldn't work out until she was about 18 or 19. And something happened. I don't know what that is, but something happened where I went from Peter to father to daddy. You know, I realized that I'll always be a father, you know, but you got to earn daddy. And very recently, my daughter lives out of town. And I want to share a story with you about what has happened with the relationship, because it really, it's. I say this with a lot of thanks to you, because I would never hear those words, "I love you," if it weren't for you guys showing me the way. My daughter called and said she is on air. She's an anchor and reporter out of state. And she said she's been down there almost a year, and she said it was the middle of the summer. She said she's invited to a wedding, Labor Day, and if this goes well with this guy, she wants to bring him home for the weekend. So a couple of days before Labor Day, I said, "Well, how's it going with him?" She said, "Well, I'm going to bring him home." I said, "I guess you like him." She said, "I think I've fallen in love." So she brings him to New York, and my wife and I take them on a cruise around the city 3 hours at night. I figured, look, this guy's going to get to know me. You know, whether he likes it or not, we'll sit on. And we got along really well, and because of time, I'll just speed this up. She goes back to where she lives, and she calls me. And she said, "Dad," she said, "you never told me. You never told me what you think of him." So I, trying to be flippant about it, said, "Well, you know, what do you think of me?" She said, "Listen," she said, "you are a lot more important than he is. I really want to know what you think of him." That's amazing. That is, for those of you that are new or just coming back, that is beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I have this precious, precious gift that's been given to me. By the way, I told her that I like him. I said, "He seems like a good guy." Very careful with the words. Seems like, we'll see. Well, don't want to give it too much. I have this gift. You know, it's one thing, especially for those of you that are new, it's one thing to get this gift, but it sure is another thing to know it's a gift. There was a time I thought that I was entitled to this. There was actually a time I thought that I was entitled to this. If I just come to meetings and act as if and sit up in the front and do service and look good and sound good, you know, I'm going to get it. Well, I'm still plagued with I want to look good and sound good. But the truth is, you got to work for this. I had to be willing to go to any lengths. And when I started this qualification, I said, I don't know how I got this, and I don't know. I mean, the truth is, if life were really fair, I wouldn't be standing here. If life were really fair, I'd be doing 25 to life for something I did in a blackout and spend my entire life in a prison not knowing what I did. And you know, all you have to do is pick up any newspaper, a news report, and many times that's exactly what happens. Or I would have gotten what I really wanted, and what I really wanted, because I didn't have the courage to do this, what I really wanted was the ultimate serenity. If I had the courage to cut my wrist that day, I wouldn't be standing in front of you. Maybe I'd been in the room so long, what I heard, I don't hear much of that these days, what I heard was, if you kill yourself, you might be killing the wrong person. I held on to that. So what I'm saying with a minute left is I'm enormously grateful for what I have. I have never forgotten where I've come from. I thank God for AA, and I thank AA for God, and thanks for having me tonight.